me just say a couple of words. He's the author of Christian Attitudes Toward Peace and War. And we understand he was a conscientious objector in the First World War. And if you would, he may or may not care to start with some remarks. And then we'll have a time of questions. If you would write your questions down, it will make things a lot quicker and easier. And also bear in mind that he has spoken for 3 hours already this morning, and he's probably tired. So,
probably
Dr. Bain.
Right.
Yeah.
When you're
is
ready.
This, is this another question?
Yes. Yeah.
It would be easier to sit, to move the microphone and sit.
Am I ready to go?
You're ready. I guess you're ready. Stand here, Dave.
Yes.
Would you rather sit?
What's that?
Would you rather sit or stand?
I read this question and this.
You want to sit down or stand up?
No, I prefer to stand up. Yes. I was asked to say whether the just war theory has a biblical basis. Well, not specifically. The Bible isn't a law book. It's an attitude. But I would give a brief review of how the theory originated. It begins with Plato, who said that the object of war is to vindicate justice and restore peace. Therefore, there should be no unnecessary violence. He was thinking mainly of war among the Greeks. They should not poison wells, and they should not cut down orchards. They should do the least possible damage because they did not intend to exterminate the enemy, but to live with the enemy after the peace was reestablished. In other words, he was very much opposed to a war of extermination, such as Athens conducted against the island of Milos, when Milos refused to ally herself with Athens against Sparta. Athens simply wiped out the whole population of the island of Milos. That was absolutely incompatible with Plato's theory of the just war. Then it is taken over by Cicero and is made to apply to the wars of Rome, and he says that Rome conquered the world in accord with the just war. Well, the point was this, that a tribe on the borders of Rome would appeal to Rome for protection against a tribe that was still farther, remote. And Rome, as a protective measure, would take over and defend this people, and having done so, would then incorporate it, and the process would continue so that Rome expanded to the Wall of Hadrian in Scotland, and the Rhine and the Danube and the Euphrates, always by defending somebody. So defensive wars could be a war of conquest. But Cicero elaborates somewhat more. Good faith is to be kept with the enemy. And the great example was Regulus, who was a captive in Carthage. And Carthage was on the point of collapse. And the Carthaginians told him they would allow him to go back to Rome if he would plead before the Roman Senate for peace. And then he'd be obligated to come back to Carthage. He went to Rome, and appearing before the Senate, he urged them to push the war with the utmost because Carthage was about to collapse. And then he returned according to his bona fides, his plighted word. And he exclaimed that he was put in a barrel with spikes on the inside and rolled over a cliff. He was the standard example of good faith in political relations. Then there was, to be no unnecessary violence. But according to Cicero, there was no room for a revolution. A war must always be conducted under the auspices of the state, because otherwise, if the private man takes it into his own hands, the result will be simply chaos. Now, this is taken over largely by Ambrose in the early church, but with him it begins to take on almost the feeling of a crusade, because the barbarians were also Arian heretics, and it's a war of the Lord. It wasn't that with Plato or with Cicero. Then Augustine takes it over, and he has the conditions of Plato. It must be to vindicate justice and restore peace. But it also must be love. And so, here you get the Christian element into it, not with specifics as to how love is to be expressed. And for Augustine, love was not incompatible with killing, because he believed that that wasn't destroying a person, it was just changing the setting to the future life. So immortality could be used as an explanation of killing in love. Now, Augustine excluded all private defense, because he said that's impossible without passion. And you can't fight a war and be with passion and be a Christian. It must be under the auspices of the state. But the Christian, although he cannot defend himself privately, may serve in a war under the leadership of the state. Again, it's under the leadership of the state. And since he doesn't know enough to know whether a war is just or unjust, he must accept the judgment of the ruler. So it is implicit obedience to the judgment of the ruler, even if he's a pagan, and love in the heart, and the use of violence only under state auspices. Well, a lot of this broke down in the barbarian invasions, and monks and nuns defended themselves without bothering about the auspices of the state. Then in the 12th century, there was a great peace movement, and the peace movement led into a crusade, because the Pope urged the warring factions in France to make peace with each other and go against the infidel. And they cried, God wills it. So you suddenly jump from a peace movement at home, which is to be facilitated by a war abroad. A war abroad will unite those at home. But then came the peace of God and the truce of God, which tried to limit the occasions for fighting until it got to be almost a summer sport, and also the number of those involved. And this is part of Augustine's plan, non-combatants should be spared. And so now they begin to increase the number of non-combatants. The doctrine was further elaborated in the Middle Ages and in the early Renaissance by Vittoria and Suarez, who introduced another principle, namely that the predictable damage done by the war should not exceed the predictable benefit to be gained thereby. So this introduces a speculative question, because you can't know exactly, obviously. But if it's plain that you'll do more damage than you'll ever gain, the war becomes immoral. Then there was the question of rebellion, because that had been excluded, but it would be legitimate to assassinate a tyrant. That was debated a good deal and was pretty hard to fit into the theory. Well, then it's largely under the impact of Protestantism that the just war theory is accommodated to revolution. And the way they do it is by making a distinction between levels of government. When the Emperor Charles was about to come up and exterminate Lutheranism, the Protestant jurists said, only the magistrate can wield the sword, but there are grades of the magistracy. If the emperor is going to exterminate the true religion, then the electors can resist him, and it'll still be magistrate against magistrate. Well, when the Lutherans got the Peace of Augsburg, they were satisfied, and they dropped that and became very constitutional in the 30 Years' War. But the Calvinists picked it up, because they hadn't been included in the Peace of Augsburg, and they said that resistance was legitimate by a prince of the blood against the crown. And Calvin disapproved of the first, the conspiracy of Amboise, because it was led by a commoner. But he approved of the first war of religion, because it was led by the Prince de Condé, who was a Bourbon and of the royal blood. Then this was carried over into England, where Parliament became the inferior magistrate against the king. But that pretty easily broke down and passed over into the crusade, which is, it's God's war, and why bother about all of these nice distinctions? The American Revolution and other revolutions on a big scale could justify themselves on the basis of the just war only by saying, we are a state, and as a state we can make war on the other state. And if they win, they're right. And if they lose, they're rebels. So the American Revolution is a rebellion from the English point of view, and the warfare of a state against a state from the American point of view. Well, those are the main developments, but the one element in it that goes all the way through is there should be no disproportionate damage, and non-combatants should be spared. Now, my friend and former student Paul Ramsey has just come out with a book in which he says that that element is inviolable. He would approve of the sinking of a navy in war because he would assume that everybody on those ships was a combatant. To which my reply is, my dear fellow, you become a practical pacifist because you can't win a war just by sinking a navy. That practically that won't go. So if you look at the facts of the case, you are opposed on Christian grounds to any war. But now somebody sent me this question. I have declared that if world peace comes, it won't be through pacifists, but through peace-minded non-pacifists. And I said, although you advocate pacifism in your book, you write that peace-minded non-pacifists are more effective. Well, there are more of them. And we're not going to get world peace unless everybody's in on it. And there are a great many people who would fight in an extremity who certainly don't want to fight. And I think the pacifists who would not fight in an extremity should join up with those who would, but in this case don't intend to. Their hands should be strengthened. Now, it's very interesting that a great many military men right now are pointing out to us that nuclear warfare is going to be a national suicide. And one of them said, suppose the Russians did attack us and kill 40 million. What good would it do to kill 40 other million? We'd simply be depopulating the earth. He said, even retaliation makes no sense with modern weapons. And of course, the big shift with regard to sparing non-combatants came with the move, not with the atom bomb, but with the move from strategic bombing to saturation bombing. And Tokyo, more were destroyed in Tokyo by saturation bombing than in numbers, actually, than in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Modern war becomes absolutely undiscriminating. It simply wipes out. And from the point of view of the traditional just war theory, all modern warfare is inadmissible. Now, as to whether it can be reconciled with Christian love, I agree that there are military men who harbor no personal resentment. When a war's all over, they'll be willing to fraternize with the former enemy. But wars as a whole are not won by those who are not wrought up to a passion like that of the My Lai massacre. Wars are not won by gentlemen. They're war by those who are stirred up by propaganda into believing that they are saving their nation or saving the world, and who fight with fierceness. It's pretty hard to justify love on any basis of morals. Now, with regard to the Bible, the Old Testament has support for the just war, for the crusade, and for pacifism. With regard to the crusade, the idea of a holy war, God's war, is in the Old Testament, and God's war tends to be more inhumane than a war over property. If it's God's war, the enemies are God's enemies and are not entitled to quarter. The Crusaders, when they conquered Jerusalem, waded up to the fetlocks of their horses in the blood of the Saracens, and then went to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to give thanks to God for their victory. War is more humane if God's left out of it, because if it's only our enemy that we're fighting, we're not as fierce as we are if we think we're fighting for the Lord God of hosts. And in the Old Testament, we have the literature of the conquest. We have Deuteronomy, which in the 20th chapter actually advocates a Holocaust. The land has been given to Israel, and how are you going to get it? Attack the Canaanite cities. If they surrender right away, then enslave the entire population. If they don't, and you win the city, leave nothing that breathes. Deuteronomy 20. It's a very unchristian chapter. We'd better forget some of the things in the Old Testament. And I am rather repelled when I read the literature that Israel ought to have the land because it was promised to Abraham. Yes, and how did they get it? As a matter of fact, I don't want to revive the Holocaust either, one way or the other. But I'd cut Deuteronomy 20 out of the Bible. It ought not to be in the canon, if you regard the Bible as a Christian book. In the Old Testament, on the other hand, we have Hosea, I have called my son out of Egypt. You have Jonah, God has mercy on that great heathen city of Nineveh. One has Isaiah, trust not to horses and chariots, thy confidence shall be in the Lord. We have the 53rd chapter where Israel is to be the redeemer of the nations. Here are passages which fit in very well with a pacifist position. Yerushalom is to be the citadel of shalom, the citadel of peace. As for specific specifications about war, we don't find it all mapped out in any legalistic fashion. Jesus didn't write the book of Leviticus. It's not a set of rules such as you have in Plato or in Cicero or even in Augustine. It's the Spirit, rather. So in the New Testament, people have found warrants for pacifism: turn the other cheek, go the other mile, love your enemies. They have found justification for war in the cleansing of the temple. But the whip of cords was not an atom bomb. And Jesus didn't exterminate anybody. You have the war ethic. You have that has been appealed to as justifying war. There's no crusade in the New Testament with regard to any earthly war. The only crusade is against the forces of hell and destruction. It's a spiritual warfare rather than a carnal warfare. But now as to the contemporary strategy, to come back to it again, I'm president of an organization called Promoting Enduring Peace. In some 15 years, I think we've reprinted about 50 million pieces of literature and sent them out free of charge. And we keep reprinting articles dealing with these issues, and now we charge a postage, that's all. And now we've had quite a grant for a TV program, and we're inviting frequently military men to speak because they're pointing out the futility of the kind of situation in which we are now involved. There are those who appeal, to the balance of power, but the trouble with the balance of power is, for one thing, you can't balance a chair with only two legs. You've got to have three, and now we've got only Russia and the United States. We haven't got a third to balance it. And the object of the balance of power is for each one to unbalance the balance in its own favor, and so they keep the arms race, on and on they go. It's costly. It depletes our resources. It stimulates inflation, and it runs the risk that somebody will push the right button. But somebody say, well, we've got to have all of these armaments in order to keep the other side from attacking us. But we wouldn't do it. That's a bluff. And the bluff is likely to be called. I heard that Reinhold Niebuhr said, but I didn't hear him say it, that if the Russians did attack us, he hoped he'd be killed in the first attack so he wouldn't have the moral responsibility of retaliation. And as for the practicality of these measures, I had quite a talk with Gerhard Ritter, a German historian, after the war. I said, would you like to have NATO move out? Oh, no. If we did, the Russians would go to the ocean. I said, would you like for the United States and the others to go to war to keep the Russians from going to the ocean? Oh, no. Germany would be the battlefield and there'd be nothing left of us. I said, then what you want really is for us to stay there to bluff. You don't want us to do it. That would be your extinction. And what do you think of the strategy of bluff? Well, now these are all prudential considerations largely, partly idealistic, but partly prudential, because prudence and moral conviction have reached the point of coincidence. John Bright was a member of Parliament throughout his career and a Quaker. He opposed every war in which England was involved. Some said, that's not fair. You've got an absolute up your sleeve, but you're always appealing to circumstance. He said, yes, I got an absolute up my sleeve, but I don't have to pull it out. Because there are enough prudential reasons why England should not be going to war in this century. So now I think the prudential and the Christian conscience and the attitude of love coincide. And I would say, therefore, not that the pacifists should mute the witness against the inhumanity of war, but should coincide with those who are aware of the utter futility of war in our present situation. Well, now if you'd like to ask questions, I'll be glad to answer for a while, or at least try to answer, or at least respond, I mean, not answer.
I think their time period may be about over, Dr. Bainton. Unless somebody has heard the question. And we can allow you to get a little rest.
I'll add only one more point. I think the strategy is to bear witness and hope. And that's it.